Welcome back to Integrative Lyme Solutions with Dr. Karlfeldt. I am so excited about the show that we have ahead of us. We have some phenomenal information that could save lives. I am Dr. Michael Karlfeldt, and with me I have my co-host,
Tanya Hobo.
You're going to need to tune in to what's going on today. The information is jam-packed, so don't step away.
So excited. Let's go ahead and get this started. Welcome to Integrative Lyme Solutions with Dr. Karlfeldt. And today is, oh my gosh, we have such an amazing guest today. Definitely a little bit different than our usual Lyme Conqueror show. But today our guest has been an investigative reporter for over 25 years. She's the nation's leading investigative writer on Lyme disease. She is also the author of Lyme, the First Epidemic of Climate Change. So a big welcome to you, Mary Beth Pfeiffer. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tanya, and thank you for all you're doing, both of you, you and Dr. Karlfeldt, to get the message out there that we need to do something about this problem.
Yeah, and it's really fascinating, your book. I mean, it really highlights that it is a problem. I mean, we know it from the people that we're talking to, but it really highlights how severe it's becoming and how much it seems to just escalate, where it was just like 50 years ago to now. It just seems to escalate more and more.
Well, it seems to be that ticks are increasingly unavoidable in many, many areas of the country. And, you know, where I live in the Hudson Valley of New York, about 100 miles north of New York City, I came to in the early 1980s, and there were very, very few ticks. And they were exotic kinds of ticks that you might see. And now, on this lovely field that I live on, which I refer to in my book, I live on the edge of it, is just riddled at many times of year with ticks. Even a snow melt kind of day in the middle of December or January can bring out ticks. And it's just a dangerous and inhospitable place. And, you know, I think that's probably a good description for a lot of the natural landscape these days, in that we dare not, you know, allow our children to roll around in the grass. And there's something very, very wrong with that because we have done very little to address it.
Yeah, and that's so scary to me. I mean, because here you want to run in nature, you want to connect with nature, you know how beneficial it is, you know, and here it's almost after reading your book, I mean, it's like it becomes a threat rather than something that is beneficial for you.
Yes. And, you know, what I tell people is it's not hopeless, of course, and we should hike and we should enjoy nature, but we have to practice vigilance. We have to check ourselves for ticks. We have to wear repellent, whether it's kind of the standard, market kind of repellent or something more natural and organic. There's both of those kinds of types out there. And I do think we can, you know, protect ourselves. We can protect our kids, but it's sometimes a lot of work. You know, I have grandkids and I bring them in this field that we own just a little part of it. And it's about 10 acres and there aren't any other houses in it. But we have gotten permission from other property owners to mow a path around it. And increasingly the path gets wider every year because kids aren't really good at avoiding that, scrubby stuff on the side. So that's one solution for us, you know, stay in the middle of the path, stay on the mowed parts. But it does take a lot of work. And I can see where a lot of people fall through the holes. A lot of kids get bitten. And then, unless you find your way to a good doctor who recognizes and treats, all bets are off.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, that's a good point, that we need to not be petrified to go out into nature. And I know that a lot of people that have dealt with Lyme, you know, they have a lot of PTSD when it comes to that. But like you said, be vigilant, you know, and part of that is being aware of what ticks are and what Lyme disease is and what it can do to you, because a lot of that is a lot of people's problems. You know, just like myself, I was very uneducated. I didn't know what a tick was. I didn't know what Lyme disease was. I had no idea what a bullseye rash was. So it's just important to, you know, be vigilant, but also to help spread the awareness for people.
Well, in so many ways, Tanya, you have to be your own advocate in the Lyme disease world.
Absolutely.
You have to protect yourself when you go outside. As I said, check yourself. But you also have to educate yourself as to what a bullseye rash looks like and how many variations that Lyme disease rash can have. Because it sometimes, even today, isn't recognized for what it is, a tick bite. I was at a fundraising dinner last night for Lyme disease, and Dr. John Aucott from Johns Hopkins spoke, and he has done a lot of work on people with what's called chronic Lyme disease, which I think is accurate, but the more acceptable term in the medical literature is post-treatment Lyme disease syndrome. But he told some stories, and one of them was a missed diagnosis that went on for a long time. But he ended with, you can't believe how many people come to me and tell me that they were told they had a spider bite. There's this like anything but Lyme mentality in medicine. Doctors have been scared off from this disease from the acute phase, though there certainly is some acceptance and a lot of treatment that goes on. That's the easier stage. But later on, the denial of care and the anything but Lyme mentality is really strong, to the point that someone with a known tick bite who never got treated can't get tested for Lyme disease. It won't even be considered in a differential diagnosis, which I'm sure you have seen, Dr. Carlfeld, a lot. And what amazes me is, as a reporter who came at this simply because I lived in a place with a lot of Lyme disease, is that how little has changed, not just since I started looking into it about 12 years ago or so, but since virtually day one. We still don't know how to properly test at, you know, every stage of Lyme disease, and we certainly don't know all its different variations and how to treat those. And I pity families with, you know, one and two and three members of the family who are sick, trying to figure out this, you know, this maze of obstacles toward wellness.
And why do you think that it hasn't moved forward much? And yeah, because obviously, yeah, it is. I mean, and you referred it to as an endemic in your book. Mm-hmm. Yeah, not epidemic. Yeah, you know, something that is here to stay. But so knowing that, why do you feel that there's still such a, avoidance? You know, one, trying to diagnose it, and then two, you know, actually treat it appropriately.
To answer that question, I'm just going to back up a little bit. I, as I said, came at this as an investigative reporter. So I started by looking into, you know, how many cases we'd had in the area that I covered in the Mid-Hudson Valley and how that trend had gone. You know, we saw the numbers go up year after year after year. And so that was a story. You know, a lot of people were getting this illness. But then I started talking to doctors and to patients. And of course, that was really where the story was. It was, I went to 5, 10, 15 doctors. I was told I had anxiety, depression, rheumatoid arthritis, fibromyalgia, the anything but Lyme diagnosis. And so there, from that point, I was like, oh my gosh, this is getting pretty complicated. Do these people really have Lyme disease? Because I was told by the mainstream literature, more or less, that you know, Lyme disease is very treatable and easily diagnosed. So, you know, no big deal. So I had these kind of this mismatch of visions of what Lyme disease was. And I had to really try and figure it out through reading the scientific literature, through talking to a lot of patients, through consulting with a lot of the advocacy groups. A very long, protracted, and very interesting exploration. And I think ultimately, to answer your question, it became clear to me that there is a small group of very powerful doctors and researchers who started out early and sort of got their claws in Lyme disease, which is a very indelicate way to put it, but they just got there first. And they made a lot of connections at medical journals. They broke news about Lyme disease. And they, over a period of time, settled on this model of Lyme disease as easy to diagnose and easy to treat. There were points along that process where they said things like Lyme disease can be chronic. Lyme disease can be passed from mother to baby in utero. The tests may not pick up Lyme disease. We may have something called seronegative Lyme disease that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. But then there came a point where this very hard and fast model of Lyme disease was put out there. And I guess that more or less, you know, coincides with the 2000 IDSA, Infectious Disease Society of America guidelines, which were updated in 2006. And it's just, long and short, is it's become extremely difficult to challenge that model. There's a lot of science to suggest that it's flawed and incomplete, but these folks still have that power and those connections, and they prevail.
And so it's almost like a turf war. I mean, we've carved this space out in the scientific literature, and we want to protect that because otherwise our names aren't immortalized.
Yes, or we have to admit that we were wrong. Ego and legacy is a big part of this, I suppose, as in any, you know, discipline. But, you know, a Lyme disease doctor who I know well repeats a truism that science advances one funeral at a time. And you know, many of the people who have held the reins on Lyme disease are aging and getting older, and perhaps there will be change when the guard changes. I certainly hope so, because there has been a plethora of developments and findings that, you know, really solidify the case against the Lyme disease serology test. I mean, it's widely accepted that it's not a good test, that we need better diagnostics. But why we don't have them by this point is really the question. You know, where is the urgency? Certainly some things have been done to try and move that along, like the tick-borne disease working group, which was assembled in Washington. I think it's put out 3 reports over the last 6 years, and not only affirmed that the test is awful, but that treatments need to be better, that more money needs to be spent on research, So again, I get back to the word I used before, mismatch. You know, the reality of what Lyme disease and tick-borne disease is contained in the pages of that tick-borne disease working group. But yet, the urgency still seems to be lacking in terms of getting the job done.
Yeah, lacking is definitely a word that we could use in this.
Yeah,
for sure.
That said, we do have a lot more money going into Lyme disease in the last few years.
We do. So an organization called Center for Lyme Action.
Yes.
I think this is the fourth year they do a fly-in every year to help raise money for Lyme disease. And I can proudly say I've been sitting on that and going up with Congress to try to get more Lyme funding for us.
Good for
and
you.
And we have been making progress each year. So it's slow progress. But it sounds like our biggest issue is, I forgot the terminology used for them, but the group of people that are aging, we need to replace them.
The guard.
Yeah, the guard. Also known as the cabal.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I have a different name, but I probably shouldn't say it.
So, I thought it was fascinating. So the term, the accurate term that you use was post-treated Lyme disorder. Was that correct?
Post-treatment Lyme disease syndrome.
Okay. So here, and that's a fascinating part, is that doctors say, well, we already treated that, so it can't be Lyme anymore. Yeah, we already gave you doxycycline for a month, and it's treated, so now it can't be Lyme anymore. So it's got to be something else. So here we're saying that post-treated Lyme disease, post-treated Lyme disease disorder, so it means that it is a disorder that is post the treatment of Lyme disease. Are they still considering it Lyme disease or something else post the treatment?
Yes, you hit on the problem exactly, because they don't want to treat Lyme disease. They don't know how to treat Lyme disease. They don't want to figure it out. Yet there are these doctors across the country, a couple of hundred or so, who do a pretty good job in that respect. But everybody, as Tanya and I were discussing, has to figure out what model works for them. You know, what doctor is offering what kind of care that might help them. But, you know, we have research as far as the post-treatment, label goes, that shows that the Lyme disease spirochete can survive in the body. You know, it can go into different forms. There are these L-shaped and these little round body forms. And that's, by my reckoning and by what I've read in the research, is pretty much proven. It hangs around when it's been under assault by doxycycline once, twice even. And it lives another day and it emerges and it, does its damage. How do we convince the naysayers that it is in fact an infection, an ongoing infection that's causing the problem? And you probably have that answer even better than I do, Dr. Carlfeld. It's a tough nut.
Yeah, it is a tough nut. I mean, literally with Lyme. Yeah, because they go into that cyst form, like you're talking, you have the L shape and then the cyst form, and the cyst form is pretty much antibiotic resistant. I mean, it's so when you do antibiotic, they just fold into that cyst and they just kind of hang on until you're done with the treatment. And then lo and behold, they bloom again.
Yeah, and that's where money for research really is just so necessary. We have to figure out how to obliterate those critters, once and for all, and what medications might work for them, what treatments. There's certainly some of that work going on. I think, Dr. Alcott is enrolling a study to use tetracycline long-term It had very, it had a lot of success in a an observational study many years ago by Dr. Donta in Boston. But you know whether that addresses the various forms or not, I don't know. I don't know that science. But we you know the bottom line is we don't have enough money for Lyme disease. When you look at the research money, there is far more per patient going to illnesses like Zika virus, which affect a very, very small number of people. West Nile virus, malaria, AIDS, certainly. I mean, AIDS is on the order of, I don't know, I think it's $50,000 per patient per year. Whereas for Lyme disease, we are still in the three figures, I believe, you know, $150 per patient per year, something like that.
Yes.
It's a huge imbalance. And it is such a huge problem, you know, for so many families and so many states and communities. It's something that we really have to fight for. And I thank you, Tanya, for doing that fly-in as part of the Center for Lyme Action, which is doing great work.
Yeah, they really are. And we talked about that. We brought that up with Congress about the funds that are available per year per patient for somebody with malaria and West Nile versus Lyme disease, which is, you know, a few hundred dollars a year versus thousands a year for something that is not even an epidemic or not the pandemic or whatever you want to call it. So we're making strides, but we need to make bigger strides, more marathon running strides or something, because too many lives are, you know, just we're only in 4 months into this new year, and I already have heard of at least a dozen patients that two lost their life due to Lyme disease, and the other handful, they took their own life because of Lyme disease. And it's got to stop. Something has to be done because it's not okay. It's not okay.
I've heard those stories as well. And right now I'm writing an article about Julia Brzezzi, who you probably have heard of as the 12-year-old girl who several years ago met the Pope as he got off of plane and arrived in New York, and she was in a wheelchair from Lyme disease and was hoping for a miracle then. She was blessed by the Pope, but she's still in a wheelchair. And she is the subject, really the lead character in a new Lyme disease documentary, which is getting some great attention and is a really good work of information and education and awareness raising about Lyme disease. And I'm in the film, by the way. I was interviewed fairly extensively, so I'm in and out telling the story from the journalist's point of view. But one thing that's happening in Julia's case is that her family is suing for medical malpractice, the pediatric group, about a dozen doctors, and two hospitals that treated and, according to the lawsuit, failed to treat her, failed to recognize initially that she had a rash that signaled the Lyme disease, and you know, at many other stages, rejected every indication that it might have been Lyme disease. She was finally clinically diagnosed about 20 months into her illness, but it had taken its toll by then. But, you know, I would like to see more legal actions take place. And, you know, I have hopes for her lawsuit. I'm following another lawsuit involving a boy by the name of Joseph Ilone, who died in 2013 from Lyme carditis a couple of weeks after returning home from summer camp. He similarly was not diagnosed. or treated. He was ill. His parents took him to the pediatrician twice. The Lyme disease test was negative, so the doctor thought no Lyme disease. And we all know that a negative test early in that in this disease does not necessarily mean no Lyme disease. So you treat clinically, you treat by symptoms. So that's another lawsuit that's ongoing. It's a wrongful death lawsuit, and that will go to trial very soon, probably next month.
And I've been hearing of a few of these. There was one recently that I heard that they actually won the case.
Yes.
And I, you know, of course, a lawsuit is never good, but I'm glad that it's happening.
Yes.
In fact, when just a little part of my story, I got bit in 04 and I woke up to a bullseye rash on my ankle and I thought there was a spider in my bed. So I threw all my blankets off. A couple hours later, I'm heading into work and my foot hurt so bad I couldn't walk on it. And so I called my primary doctor of probably 15 years at that time, told him what happened. He says, oh, come in right away. So I left work. I went to my primary doctor. I showed him the absolute bullseye rash on my foot or on my ankle. And he gave me a pain shot. I remember that. And he was very specific with me when he said, keep an eye on it. If you get sick in the next week or if anything weird happens to you, you call me right away. And I was like, oh, okay, that sounds weird, but okay. And nothing happened until 4 years later. I went back to him and he sent me down the rabbit hole for a couple of years, knowing that I had that bite. And I reached out to an attorney because I wanted to sue him. He took 13 years of my life from me. And, you know, the attorneys just laughed at me. But, yeah, so I'm glad people are getting somewhere with that.
You hit on a number of problems there, and one of them is getting attorneys to take these cases because they are very difficult to win because, essentially, the doctors are following the Lyme disease guidance. Certainly, when a doctor misses an obvious signal of Lyme disease, namely the bullseye rash, that seems to indicate negligence. But you were in Northern California, I think you said?
I was, yeah. And I know, you know, hindsight looking back on it, he knew that that was a tick bite. Because why would he say to me, if you get sick in the next week, a fever or the flu, let me know. Like all of it just makes sense now. There's not a doubt in my mind that he knew what that was. He was obviously afraid to admit it or couldn't admit it or couldn't bring up Lyme disease. Even when I went back to him 4 years later being sick, it was never brought up by him. He just kept sending me to referrals to different infectious disease doctors. And
I think that goes to all the hurdles that have been put in front of patients toward a true and valid diagnosis and treatment. And in Northern California, it was even worse. I think it still may be that you needed both a positive test and evidence of a tick bite. A rash and a positive test, I think. I know that the bar was a lot higher and probably still is because it wasn't considered a place where Lyme disease was endemic. It was a low, this is what it is. It was a low prevalence area of the country. But, you know, the technicalities kind of don't matter here. They just make it difficult to achieve a diagnosis and treatment. And doctors consequently run away from Lyme disease. They're warned off Lyme disease because they've been told that this model works, that we have a test that, yeah, sure, it may fail early on, but sooner or later, it'll turn positive. Well, by that time, the patient with the rash, like yourself, has gone on with their lives. The symptoms have gone away. it just is a flawed system, and it certainly didn't work for you, Tanya, not only because you lived in Northern California, but because of what Lyme disease is.
Right, and I think the CDC, the way that they have their testing guidelines is you have to have, I don't recall how many bands, but you have to have so many bands according to the CDC to be positive. So I had a positive Igenix test, but it was not CDC positive. So when I took that to a doctor, the doctor says, no, you don't have Lyme disease because you only have this many bands and not that many bands. And so that's another flaw in the system as well, is how they're doing their guidelines.
And doctors have seen what happens to other doctors who choose to go outside those guidelines. The doctors who will take one specific band that's very indicative of Lyme disease and say, okay, you know, combined with all your symptoms, I'm going to diagnose you as having Lyme disease. Well, that doctor might get a call or a letter from the state licensing board, might go up for charges, might be charged with, you know, record keeping errors, anything that often does not have anything to do with their care. But that form of often harassment to uphold, in the name of upholding the Lyme disease guidelines, is very effective in keeping other doctors, mainstream doctors, in line. Yeah. It's very unfortunate.
Yeah, I mean, I think the key is, you know, like what you're mentioning, loss or kind of going after legal action will kind of balance that fear, because all doctors are about liability. You know, what is my liability, and I want to stay away from anything that will impact my license or impact somebody suing me. So if more people then. And it's kind of unfair to the doctors, you know, because they are put in that position due to the CDC guidelines. But still, there's got to be some push somewhere, because there's so many people suffering. You know, like, you know, Tanya here, 13 years of her life. You have, you know, the little boy with, you know, Lyme myocarditis, and, you know, see, there's so many people suffering. So there has to, if there's more pressure, you know, legal action pressure onto the doctors or onto whatever institution that we're able to, then I think that will gradually start to shift.
Well, I sure hope so. One very disturbing aspect of this for me is the role of Big Pharma, just in general, in our lives. So many people are on drugs for chronic illnesses, illnesses that might in fact be Lyme disease, like fibromyalgia, immune system, you know, autoimmune diseases. And that's very beneficial to Big Pharma. So there's not a heck of a lot of incentive for them, certainly, to solve this problem. And the FDA and our government generally is very closely allied with Big Pharma, and Big Pharma pays for a lot of the budget of the FDA, something like 50 to 75% of the drug testing budget is from pharmaceutical companies. So those kinds of nefarious relationships and the money that further pharmaceutical companies give to Congress in terms of lobbying and support for elections has vastly corrupted our medical model. And I saw that with my coverage with COVID. Lyme disease greatly prepared me to cover COVID, because I knew about those relationships that are not healthy.
Yeah, and then along with that, then you have the media cartels, you know, that are then also controlled by Big Pharma money, because, you know, Big Pharma money, that's where they advertise. And then you have the universities that are controlled by Big Pharma money. And like you say, I mean, the solution is not I mean, you don't make money on fixing problems. You make money on managing problems. And so if you can keep somebody in a state where you're managing their symptoms, you know, Big Pharma will make more money.
Mm-hmm. And I agree totally with you on that. So that's, I think, why the status quo has largely persisted in lung disease, just as Lyme persists in people's bodies. But on the legal front, we did have a really good attempt made to challenge the IDSA guidelines, the Infectious Diseases Society of America guidelines, and the major players who crafted those and upheld them over the years. And that was a lawsuit filed by Lisa Torrey and a couple of dozen other chronic Lyme disease patients. And it had a very good seasoned law firm behind it. And it had some success, but ultimately failed. First of all, the doctors were let off the hook, and then ultimately IDSA. But it is now being appealed. And I'm told there is some reason to hope that it will live another day. I don't know, you know, too many details beyond that, because it hasn't gotten that far in the process. But the lawsuit is framed as an antitrust lawsuit, that this group of IDSA doctors and the IDSA as an organization conspired to drive other doctors out of business who practiced a different model of Lyme disease, and that violated antitrust statutes in the United States. So we can hope that that'll move forward. It certainly seems like a pretty reasonable idea that in fact happened, yeah, but proving and it could, was the problem.
Yeah, that could be a big thing for us. Mm-hmm. If a case like that can, like you say, live another day.
Yeah. Well, I wrote about that, and if folks want to go to my website, they can read some of the articles about the Torrey lawsuit. They can read other articles that I wrote about Lyme disease and you know, failures of testing. And I wrote about congenital Lyme disease. That one took me a long time to figure out, and to, you know, in my kind of progression and my education about Lyme disease, to at last say, this is a real thing. And it really has been just pushed aside and not given its due. So I wrote an article that you can find links to for Scientific American online. Anyway, my website is thefirstepidemic.com. Very easy to find the articles tab there, thefirstepidemic.com.
Awesome. We will definitely share that on the title to this as well, so people can find that information.
And I would love to, I mean, the title of your book, I mean, I know we've gone into the legal and to, but it's understanding a little bit as to why it is becoming such an endemic now versus before. I mean, what, and obviously for moving in a linear or exponential fashion in that direction, you know, what we're seeing is just the beginning, it almost sounds like. So why, for our listeners, why are we where we're at now in regards to Lyme?
Well, we have, as a species, vastly altered the earth. We have changed the earth in so many ways. We have cut down forests and built highways and created these little suburban enclaves all around cities. We have sliced and diced our forests and created an environment, apart and aside from the fact that it's getting warmer, we'll discuss that too, but an environment in which the ecosystem and the ecosystem qualities are really good for the survival of ticks. There are few predators for the small mice and voles and mammals that really love all these little suburban places where they can find things to eat, you know, acorns and garbage, and they can get inside of houses. And these little, you know, these small mammals are the reservoirs for Lyme disease. And the things that would kill them naturally, like foxes, there aren't very many of them. So we've changed, really changed the environment, and we've done it in a way that lets ticks live. And the other thing is, as it gets warmer, and you guys just cut out, I see.
Oh, yeah, we
lost our video.
We lost our video.
Okay.
You can still hear us, though.
Okay, yes, I can.
Okay.
Okay. Well, the other thing is that as it gets warmer, we do see a progression, a northward progression in the northern hemisphere of ticks. We can just document their movement, for example, from the U.S. into Canada. I say in my book that Canada is a new frontier for Lyme disease and for ticks as the ticks move northward. There's even scientific studies showing that the type of mouse that is best as a reservoir for Lyme disease is also moving north into Canada. Some of the research I came across was really kind of interesting in that, you know, 50 years ago, some, you know, scientists wanted to answer the question of how far north on a mountain in the Alps, how far up a tick could live. So found a tick at, I don't know, something like a 1,000 meters. And so, you know, another scientist goes back 50 years later and finds, oh, lo and behold, they've moved up a couple hundred meters since then. We're seeing them move altitudinally, namely up, and we're also seeing them move latitudinally, namely north, north into Sweden and Norway. And, you know, just there's more ticks in more places. And they have, you know, a great rate of survival. Birds in particular move them around. And birds have done that, by the way, for eons. But now when a bird carries a tick, you know, several thousand miles during a migration and drops that tick, the tick has a much better chance of survival. Lyme disease has been around for a long time, but it is just having a really great run right now because we've set everything in motion to allow it to proliferate and to survive.
And that's kind of the fascinating thing is that when you have nature exist in a certain way over eons of time and it creates a certain type of homeostasis.
Yeah.
And then we have a quick disruption, you know, which is what we've done, you know, with our species. We have altered the earth, you know, during a short period of time. Mm-hmm. So this homeostasis obviously is disrupted quite a bit. And then there's, you know, it's going to favor somebody or something that will then have an advantage over others. And it seems like ticks are then one of those species that are really being favored by these changes.
Yes. And you know, they don't seem to serve any purpose in nature either. You know, they don't keep any other species alive. They're not an integral part of the food chain, which I suppose should tell us something. We are out of balance, in short. One of the little anecdotes I have in my book that was very interesting is there was a professor from University of Oregon, and he went to, and we do this regularly, to Central America. I believe it was the Dominican Republic. And he brought back a big hunk of amber 20 years ago. And what he does is he slices it and looks for all these little indicators of what happened a long, long, long time ago. And this particular piece of amber was estimated to be about 10 to 20 million years old. And lo and behold, he found a tick encased in that amber, and he put it under an electron microscope, and he could see the outlines of little squiggly spirochetes, presumably beryllia, way back in the day, or at least its ancestor.
Wow.
Isn't that incredible?
Yeah.
So so it's had all this time to adapt and evolve to be able to survive pretty much anything.
Yes, and that is a point that a number of scientists make. It is extremely adaptable. You know, when you think of what it needs to do to survive and the different environments that it survives in. I mean, it survives in the dirt here in upstate New York in 10 below weather. Then it emerges, and then it bites a warm-blooded creature. So it goes from very cold to the body of a tick, which is not warm, to a warm-blooded creature, has to figure out how to get, you know, through that gateway and fend off all the things that are trying to kill it as it's arriving. I mean, it's a really, really smart bug. There's a guy at University of, Amir Hodzik, I can't remember where he is, UC Davis. And he says, Borrelia has a really big brain. I really respect Borrelia.
So why does it say that? I mean, I know genetically, you know, people have compared it to syphilis, you know, and but if you look genetically, Borrelia, the spirochete compared to syphilis, is like, you know, comparing an elephant to just a little flea. You know, it's so much more advanced than syphilis. So so when it says it has a really big brain, is that a relationship then with to the body and proportional?
I think he's referring to its ability to adapt.
Yeah,
he has done a number of studies in mice in which he inoculates mice with Borrelia, infects them with Lyme disease, treats them, waits 4 months, 12 months, whatever, and he just can't kill the Borrelia. He keeps finding Borrelia in these mice, despite, you know, we putting all of our tools to the task of killing them.
Well, and that's very believable because, you know, there's question whether or not you can truly get rid of chronic Lyme disease, or if the spirochetes are going to hide in your body forever. They're just really, really smart. And, you know, like when we talked about earlier, giving you 30 days of doxycycline, a lot of people right off the bat will feel better. But as soon as they're off the doxy, they're sick again because they hide. They're very smart little things. And then, they're not even cute. Like you said, what are they even around for? Like, we don't need them.
And we haven't really even touched on co-infections and how that muddies the water and makes things much worse. And all the questions we have on how to treat them long-term when they, you know, Bartonella, this is a tough one, and Babesia, and there's a dozen others. I mean, ticks are cesspools of infection. And I guess that gets back to, you know, we need to put research money to the task. You know, with Lyme disease itself, I was talking with somebody last night about how it manifests itself differently in different people. The woman I was speaking with had 9 joint replacements. And so that's someone who's clearly the musculoskeletal manifestation of Lyme disease. And yet some people, it affects them, you know, their brains and other systems. It just is it's a tough bug to figure out, and has just so many ways of manifesting itself and doing damage to the human body.
And I think, because here you have something that is so able to adapt, just the spirochete in itself. So obviously when it gets into new environment and new terrain, which a human being is, then it will adapt, you know, depending on what's going on with the immune system, depending on detox abilities depending on stressors and all they may be. And then you also have, as you said, you know, to add then all the different co-infections. So and they keep becoming more and more, yeah, you know, and mm-hmm. So now you have all these different factors, you know, creating then a collision that can create almost any type of disease. Yeah, you know, that's mm-hmm. that's why it's the great mimicker, because you really, really don't know.
And that is also what allows medicine to do what it's doing right now, is just call it something else, because it imitates virtually anything else. And the doctor who calls it something else, like fibromyalgia or rheumatoid arthritis, is going to get insurance reimbursement for that patient's treatment and medications. But call it chronic Lyme disease, and that's not going to happen.
And he may not be a doctor anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. It's truly just a vicious cycle. It mm-hmm. it really is. The tick itself mm-hmm. is a vicious cycle, yeah. But then the whole government, the whole surrounding of, you know, testing and treating is just, it's horrible.
Well, me being the journalist, I'd like to ask a question of you, Dr. Carlfeld.
Please.
Have you seen progress in terms of treatment methods that you can use? Have you seen any that come along that really give you hope?
I think the issue is, I don't think we've found anything that eradicates Lyme. Yeah. So mm-hmm. what we're looking at is to create an environment that Lyme can coexist without symptoms. And so we have therapies like the photodynamic, something that I do, ozone, something that I do. And then just kind of work on the stressors and the immune system and immune system modulation, because that becomes a huge factor. It's not always the pathogen in itself. It is how the immune system is responding to the pathogen that can then trigger a lot of these symptom manifestations. So it becomes sad to say, like management even on the natural side, because we really don't have a way. It's kind of like once you've got herpes, you get herpes. You know, it's once it's there, it's there. You can't really go and get rid of everything in the body. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you have the hyperthermia. It's a very good one. You know, hyperbaric oxygen along with that is powerful. So they're powerful tools that are helpful.
Yes. And certainly what you do for your patients takes a lot more time, I would think, than a standard doctor, primary care doctor, or infectious disease doctor would have to give to each and every patient. Because from what you're telling me, it's a different thing for each patient, even though they may all have Lyme disease. But you have to figure out what works for each patient, and it can be a complex menu of solutions.
Exactly. It's not you can't create a standard of care model, you know, mm-hmm. where you have this disease, this drug. You know, it just doesn't work, because each individual is unique. You have, like we're just discussing, you know, it's a different set of infectious agents that you're dealing with. And depending on the individual, you know, where the health was prior to, genetic weaknesses, you know, stressors, it will then manifest in different ways. So you have to then account for that. And that cannot be solved in, you know, an 8-minute visit and here, take this pill. So doctors are not going to be able to be reimbursed for that amount of time, because they're not going to be able to solve that issue, you know, in the allotted insurance, you know, insurance model. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that is the issue. That's why we have to kind of step away from that model and let another group, so to say, take over the management of that disease.
Mm-hmm. Is there a parallel disease that is similarly complex that is, I don't know, dealt with appropriately in our society. It's funny, I don't think I ever thought of that question before, but you know, certainly cancer is difficult to figure out and must entail different solutions for different patients.
And that is kind of, because those are my two fascinations. Yeah, you have cancer, I would say, be my number one fascination. And then Lyme would be kind of the second right after. And they're very similar in the same way, meaning that, you know, once you have cancer, you really don't have cancer ever again. I mean, it's a chronic disease, and it's not something that where you just, here, take this drug and it's going to eradicate the cancer, because mm-hmm. cancer is a systemic disease and there are a lot of different drivers, and it is intelligent and it's figured out how to adapt and how to adjust in the environment that it's in, and it's manipulating the immune system just like Lyme does, manipulating the immune system for its own benefit and for its own survival. Mm-hmm. So you have to then look at what can I do to bring the body back into a state where this can be contained and it cannot take over the system. So then you have to work on things like the mitochondria. You have to, what can I do to kind of reduce inflammatory factors and control the immune system and how it's behaving? How can I minimize the other type of stressors that we can't control, like toxic exposures? Is there another point that you would like to address? I mean, I think we've hit a lot of great points.
Yeah. I just don't want to leave people with too bleak a picture of what's going on in the Lyme disease world. There's a lot of nonprofit money going toward research because, frankly, people who have a lot of money have Lyme disease in their families and they give money toward research. You know, literally a couple of $100 million in the last few years, and that's supporting some good research. You know, government research money is going up. The Tick-Borne Disease Working Group has done incredibly great work. All of their reports are online. The last one is really terrific, and it has some references to research that's going on now for better tests and for better treatments. So there is hope. It's, by my account, moving way too slowly, but it is moving, I think.
Yeah,
so
and
I would leave it there.
I think that's important too, because, you know, as the listeners probably are realizing that, you know, all of our episodes are about those who have beaten Lyme disease, and we kind of mm-hmm. change things up a little bit with you mm-hmm. having joining us, which has been incredibly amazing. But yeah, so we have lots of stories of hope for the listeners out there. And mm-hmm. I can back up even what you're saying, that when I got my diagnosis in 2015, here we are mm-hmm. in 2023, things have gotten so much better just in that mm-hmm. short amount of time. Mm-hmm. I agree with you as well. It's moving way too slow, but mm-hmm. there is hope, and changes are, you know, happening. And there are a lot of doctors out there like Dr. Carlfelt that is, you know, putting himself on the line and treating the Lyme patients, because we need those doctors out there to not be overran by, what's it called, the guard, the circle of people?
Yeah, yeah. The cabal.
The cabal, yeah.
So they're definitely, it's important to know what's going on out there and why things are mm-hmm. happening the way that they are. So mm-hmm. I think this has been, you know, very insightful for those listeners to kind of understand a little bit more of what's going on with it.
Okay. Well, thank you for having me, and keep doing your great work.
Thank you so much. And thank you. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
And what is the name of your book again for listeners that they...
It's called Lyme, The First Epidemic of Climate Change. It's on Amazon. Easily findable there.
Yeah, and I can attest it was a fascinating read. So thank you so much.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
The information in this podcast is for educational purposes only and is not designed to diagnose or treat any disease. I hope this podcast impacted you as it did me. Please subscribe so that you can be notified when new episodes are released. There are some excellent shows coming up that you do not want to miss. If you're enjoying these podcasts, please take a moment to write a review and please don't keep this information to yourself. Share them with your family and friends. You never know what piece of information that will transform their lives. For past episodes and powerful information on how to conquer Lyme, go to integrativelymesolutions.com and an additional powerful resource, limestream.com. For Lyme support and group discussions, join Tanya on Facebook at Lyme Conquerors Mentoring Lyme Warriors. If you'd like to know more about the cutting-edge integrative Lyme therapies my center offers, please visit thecarlfeldcenter.com. Thank you for spending this time with us, and I hope to see you at our next episode of Integrative Lyme Solutions with Dr. Carlfeld.